The Special Features Division of WOR brings you at this time the official closing ceremonies at the New York World's Fair 1939. During this broadcast, we shall take you to several vantage points on the fairgrounds for word pictures of the first act curtain in this spectacle of the world of tomorrow. But here, in the Mardi Gras Casino, is WOR's World's Fair reporter, that old smoothie, Ed Fitzgerald. Take it, Ed.
Good morning, neighbors. Good morrow. This is it. This is the deadline. The witching hour at the great international exhibit known as the New York World's Fair. Gray, weeping skies greeted this day and brought probably one of the smallest crowds of the entire year. It rained and the wind blew, but they came and they came to have fun. Extra police precautions were taken on every side to protect the property from sabotage and damage. However, many of the exhibits closed down to avoid what they thought might be unruly crowds. However, I might say it's been very quiet, there's been no disturbance, and it's been entirely too wet for the boys to play rough outdoors. However, here, in this Mardi Gras casino, some 3,500 enthusiastic young Americans are jitterbugging like mad to the splendid music of Jack Teagarden and his boys. I think it would be futile and a waste of time for me to discuss anything beyond this point, so I say to you, Mr. Teagarden, please play your swell number, Man and His Dream.
Thank you.
Here are the boys and girls cheering enthusiastically for Jack Tiergarten and his boys. I want to tell you, I have never seen such a spectacle as this in all my life. Outside, it's raining and storming like mad. Inside, we've got 3,500 enthusiastic young jitterbugs, young Americans living for the world of tomorrow. There's so much more I would like to tell you about this big pitch up here tonight, but I'm afraid this crowd would tear me and Mr. Tiergarten limb from limb. They're here to dance. They're here for music. Oh, you're going to hear music. You're going to hear a number written by Mr. Tiergarten called, oddly enough, Swinging on a Tiergarten Gate. Give, my lad, give. But now let's move on from this colorful scene. World's Fair executives are waiting to make a brief report of the year's activities and give us a glimpse of what we may expect in 1940.
Ladies and gentlemen, Commander Howard A. Flanagan, Executive Vice President of the World's Fair and Administrative Officer in Charge of Operations. Commander Flanagan.
In speaking to you this morning at this last late closing hour of the New York World's Fair of 1939, I want not only to express the corporation's and my own wholehearted appreciation of the enthusiastic interest and support which you, the public, have given this exposition in the season just past, but also to invite you, one and all, to plan on renewing that friendship by returning early and often when we open the gates next May the 25th on the New York World's Fair of 1940. We have already received assurances from so many of our industrial participants, from state and other governmental agencies, and from the amusement world of their intention of being with us again next year that we feel we have every right to promise you that the fair in 1940 will be even more spectacular than the one of 1939. We know that in the exhibit area, many of our exhibitors, large and small, are planning to increase the interest of their exhibits and to present an even more impressive demonstration of the new and powerful art of improving public relations and stimulating consumer interest in their product through the medium of display showmanship. The foreign area, where this year so many of you have formed acquaintances with the people and the products of dozens of our international neighbors, will undoubtedly be as large as this year's. And according to projected ideas for its 1940 character, will it be even more interesting and more effective in bringing our people in touch with the people of other lands thereby creating a better understanding of their problems and their progress. These same ideals will, of course, dominate our thinking in the planning of the States area, for which the cornerstone has already been laid in the signing of the contract for the state of Florida's participation in 1914, several days ago. And tonight, New Jersey will become the second to fall in line by the signing of its participation agreement immediately following this broadcast. In this connection, and at this time, I wish to take the opportunity of expressing my thanks and congratulations to Governor Moore and to Mr. George de Benville Keim, Chairman of the New Jersey's New York World's Fair Commission, for the constant and diligent efforts which they have put forth to put this state before the public by its participation in the New York World's Fair of 1939 and make possible its participation again in 1940.
Thank you, Commander Flanagan. And now, before we terminate our broadcast in the New Jersey building, may I present Mr. George de Benville Keim, Commissioner General of the State of New Jersey, who will officially record New Jersey's participation in the fair next year. Mr. DeCon.
Commander Flanagan, Governor Moore of New Jersey has recently proclaimed that the state of New Jersey would participate in the World's Fair of 1940. And it is a great pleasure on my part to sign the agreement with Commander Flanagan this evening for us, for the state of New Jersey, to participate in the fair of 1940. Every effort will be made by us to make our exhibit as great or even more interesting than the one that we had in 1939. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And now, ladies and gentlemen, just before we leave, I'd like to introduce to you Dr. John S. Young, the director of radio and television for the New York World's Fair, who's done such a swell job. And may I say, in behalf of the broadcasters of the nation, that he has really done a swell job, whereas the media of publicity and other diversions may have fallen by the wayside just a bit because of world conditions and other factors, that Dr. John S. Young has really made us conscious of the New York World's Fair by radio. So, John, come on in and tell them what we may expect from you next year.
Thank you, Dave. I am very happy to have this opportunity to express my gratitude to the Mutual Broadcasting System for their excellent work and sincere cooperation during the New York World's Fair of 1939, and to thank their gracious chairman of the board, my very dear friend, Mr. Alfred J. McCosker, for the many services he has afforded us. I would like to express also my heartfelt appreciation to Mr. Neville Miller, the president of the National Association of Broadcasters, the controlling body of the radio broadcasting industry in the United States, for his courtesy and his assistance given to us during the fair of 1939. The New York World's Fair has been, I believe, an impressive display of the desire of men and women of the entire world to work together peacefully and constructively. For 3 years and over since its inception and during the actual construction, some 60-odd nations have worked side by side to bring their finest and most representative products, their hopes, their plans, their ideals to this great exposition. The field of radio, and particularly the Mutual Broadcasting System, has carried the story of those men and women and their hopes and plans to millions and millions of listeners throughout the world. It has inspired them to visit the fair, and to those unfortunates who were unable to attend the exposition, those that we call in radio the shut-ins, it has brought a little of the excitement and the color of this greatest show on earth into their lives. In this brief but sincere message, I would like to thank everyone who has worked with me in bringing the message of the New York World's Fair to millions. May the strong chain of the Mutual Broadcasting System grow ever stronger. We have depended upon and appreciate the splendid cooperation given to us at the fair by everyone in radio. We look forward with eagerness to our work for the New York World's Fair of 1940. And so we say, hail and farewell. The New York World's Fair of 1939 has ended. Long live the fair of 1940.
Thank you, Dr. John S. Young, Johnny, to us in radio, and we're looking forward to many swell programs from you during the coming winter and next year. And now, down in the Midway, scores of last night visitors are swarming about, taking a last look at midgets, headless women, carnivals, and other attractions. For a word picture of the amusement area, we switch you to little old New York.
And this is Alvin Giuseppe speaking from the dark and cold and wet entranceway of little old New York, and finding it difficult to conjure up the memories of this last bright summer when vast throngs pushed their way here along the midway loops, under colored lights and past noisy barkers. Facing the south, along dark streets filled with puddles, we can see the carnival area that 32 million fairgoers saw during this year. There are the ghostly gray walls of Merry England, the windmill of the Dutch village, and the giant white framework of the roller coaster. Then the rain-drenched tower of the parachute jump, now looming up in an uncomfortable night. Back on the other loop is the deserted Sun Valley snow village, the shacks of the sideshows and machinery of the thrill rides, the great revolving cash register, the midget village, and the blue and white music hall where Bill Robinson nightly danced through the hot Mikado. Finally, across the way is the massive stadium where Billy Rose's Aquacade delighted thousands. Over everything tonight hangs the somber and deadening fog of something old and deserted, and yet we all know that next year this same area will again burst out in a blaze of lights and music and noise and color. For the amusement area, like all the fair tonight, is just closing its eyes and taking a long winter snooze. And now one of America's youngest and most successful showmen is standing beside me. He's Michael Todd, who presented the Hot Mikado Show at the big music hall here. Mr. Todd, you were good enough to brave the cold and join us tonight. Now I have some questions to ask you about show business in the amusement area. You brought the Hot Mikado out here after it had been a successful Broadway play. Was it just as successful out here?
Indeed it was.
Well, did you have to make any changes before bringing it here?
We cut the show a little, shorter running time, so as that we wouldn't keep the people in theater too long, so you could enjoy the rest of the fair.
What are you going to do with it this winter?
We're touring the show. We're opening in Hartford this week. Go to Boston next week. I'm standing on a ballet stand, so I can't resist a plug for the show. Matinees Wednesdays and Saturdays in Boston next week.
Is Bill Robinson going along with you?
Yes, indeed he is. Bojangles himself is going with us.
Well, Mr. Todd, are you going to be out here again next year?
I expect to be here at the Hall of Music.
What are you going to have with you here?
I'm going to do a show, a review, designed especially for the fair.
Do you think showmen have learned any lessons from this year's fair?
Well, I should think they would. Across from us is Billy Rose's Aquacade, which played to millions. Correcting you, you said thousands, 5 million to be exact. I'm not Rose's press agent, but he did such a great job. And he showed all us showmen what can be done with intelligent showmanship and at the right price.
Do you think people's tastes for carnival entertainment have changed?
Definitely. I feel as though radio and newspapers have, I'll say smartened up people to the extent where there are no more rubes. You've got to give them a great show and at a small price.
Well, therefore, do you think it follows that there'll be more of the extravaganza-type show out here next year?
I'm sure there will be.
Besides you, do you know of any others that will be here?
Well, I know... I'm sure Rose will be here.
With something new, eh?
I imagine it'll be new, knowing Billy Rose.
All right, thank you very much, Michael Todd. And now I want to introduce Jerry Danzig, who conducted the popular Welcome Neighbor program from the fair all this year over Mutual.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. An occasion like this brings up certain memories. Alvin spoke of some, Dave Driscoll earlier in the evening, and Ed Fitzgerald, the World's Fair reporter. And I can't help looking back and remembering an evening back in March when Mayor LaGuardia sat down with Dave Driscoll and me in the quiet studios of WOR. Because standing out here now in this rather lonely, rather deserted place with our few distinguished guests, with Bill Carr of the radio department of the fair standing here holding his coat practically over the microphone so that the cold wind won't whistle down so that to destroy your listening pleasure, it's a far cry. A long haul, and as a cop said or a policeman said to us this evening, the only activity out here is the closing of doors. We've been sitting indoors a few minutes ago by a heater, so that gives you some idea of perhaps what it's like around here. Now and then a boy or a girl goes by, sometimes in twos, sometimes in fours, and so on, to say hello, but all's quiet on the front here. But now here's a guest, a distinguished guest, because his attraction is also an outstanding one, Commander James H. Strong, the designer and operator of the parachute jump here at the fair. Commander, you stopped your operation when? How long ago?
Sunday night.
Too much wind and...
The weather was too wet and too much wind.
Well, what are your plans for next year, sir?
Well, we're negotiating with the fair to probably take the tower down and move it up to the other end of the fair.
And I heard something about the fact that you may also increase your capacity. Is that right?
We, at the favorable location up this other end, we'd probably double our capacity.
How many people rode on the parachute tent?
Over 500,000, about 551,000.
Which is indeed a very large quantity. Sir, I remember the thing that stood out most and probably the memories of all of our listeners was the occasion in which one of the jumps stuck, or rather one of the parachutes stuck one night. What was the ultimate effect of that? Did that keep people away, or did more people ride on the fair?
On the contrary, keeping them away, the people just came down there to ride that particular chute.
And that was the ultimate effect.
Well, the reaction was they saw that the ride was perfectly safe and they couldn't get hurt, and actually they wanted to come down and ride that particular chute.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much for coming down here and joining us in our little circle of people here this evening. And now here's Alvin Giuseppe with another guest.
There's a young man here who many of our listeners will remember seeing and meeting while at the fair. His name is Harry Spear, and he's tall and angular. Harry, you worked all year right here at little old New York, didn't you?
Yes, I did, Mr. Giuseppe.
What did you do?
Oh, my name is Chuck Connors. I'm the mayor of little old New York. Anything I can do for you lovely ladies and gentlemen, it'll be a pleasure. Any spots you boys can't get into, just tell them Chuck Connors sent you. You'll be all right, because I'm your pal. Yes, I am.
That was your spiel, hey?
Yes, it was, Mr. Giuseppe.
Well, maybe many of our listeners remember it. What are all you entertainers going to do during the winter, Harry?
Well, I had a great many conversations with most of the performers on the amusement area, and from what I gathered, some of the barkers have jobs with carnival shows touring throughout the country. A great many of them are going home to their wives and sweethearts they haven't seen for over 5 months. A lot of the chorus girls have jobs with the cafes in New York, such as the Paradise Restaurant, the International Casino. Just a little plug for them. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. And my own little show in little old New York, we're touring on the road. We open in Stamford, Connecticut, and at November 11th. We're having Pat Rooney with us and our orchestra and the Chester Hale girls, and we hope people will come to see us.
Well, Harry, will most of you be back here next year?
I hope so. It looks very promising.
You think there are a lot of shows lined up for you?
Yes, I do.
You practically lived in this amusement area during the year, Harry. What were some of the highlights you witnessed? Or let's give just one. Time's
really
short.
Well, the highlight of the year for me, Mr. Giuseppe, was the way I got my job. It was very unusual. The opening night, you know, they had announced that Eddie Cantor and Burns and Allen would appear in person. And they did at 7 p.m. And then they left. But the barkers outside continued to announce the presence of Eddie Cantor and Burns and Allen. And 9,000 people jammed the square. I was sitting on the terrace of the Knickerbocker Inn, and the people didn't see Cantor or Burns and Allen. They yelled for their money back. Gosh, it was a riot. Pandemonium reigned. So I thought I'd take a little chance, and I went upon the Bowling Green stage, spoke to the audience, had a little trouble at first, but was fortunate to win them over in a measure, and I gave impersonations of Cantor and Jessel, sang a lot of songs and told some jokes and did a show by myself for 40 minutes. The executives were sitting on the official balcony. They sent for me, asked me who I was, and I said, why, I'm just a...
P.S., you got the job.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes.
All right. Thanks very much, Harry. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we say goodbye to the amusement area, where tomorrow the babble of voices will be replaced by the clatter of hammers as workmen board up the concessions for the winter. We take you now to the dark and deserted Court of Peace.
Hello, goblins. This is one of the goblins in the Court of Peace. I feel like a goblin. I look like a goblin. There's nobody here but goblins, so I must be a goblin. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dave Driscoll speaking from a sopping wet and cold Court of Peace. The sky overhead is clear now and the rain has disappeared. The amusement area may have had its stragglers, but the exhibit area in the foreign section is completely evacuated. At precisely 9 o'clock, the goblins in the Lagoon of Nations put on their last show of the season. A few of the hardy last night visitors stood out under umbrellas and watched, and over in front of the Norwegian Pavilion, a little crowd stood about and cheered as someone ran down the nation's colors from the mast above the door. It probably was the first time any one of the nation's flags was run down during the entire 6 months' run of the fair. It sounds odd, I know, but even now the flags of other pavilions and other nations flap and blow in the wet air. A driving rain had beaten down on the World's Fair European front for the last 2 days, and this foreign section, as I said, is now inhabited only by Halloween goblins and the ghosts of some of the world's greatest personalities. On this very platform from which I speak have trod the great and the meek,
President Roosevelt opened the World's Fair from this point. Their Majesties King George VI and Queen Elizabeth of England made a triumphal appearance here. The Crown Princes and Princesses of Norway and Denmark spoke to their American friends from this platform. Cordell Hull, Secretary of State of this country, from this stage made an impassioned but fruitless plea for world peace. The high and mighty of international business, religion, science, and education walked across this court. Literally, millions of people have sat in the now wet and empty seats, listening or dozing. Truly, the greatest collection of names and intellect have assembled in this and other sections of the World Fair. Likewise, in fairness to the worthy ones, this stage has accommodated plenty of persons who would be called phonies in certain society. It's true that if all the useless adjectives that have been bellowed and barked from this stage were laid end to end, we could all run around the world on them for two or three times. But before we leave this nerve center of the New York World's Fair, I'd like to say that this has provided America with the greatest display of history and progress, culture, and entertainment the world has ever known. There were a lot of harsh things said at times about personalities and procedure, but nevertheless, there were plenty of people here tonight, people who came for the first time who wanted to come again. They will come next year, and they'll come along with the thousands who saw the fair on more than one occasion this year. I, for one, feel I passed up scores of exhibits that it would have taught me something, and I'm coming back next year. What has closing night been at the fair? Well, the weather kept merrymakers away, and the greatest celebrations took place within the exhibits, where those who answered the inane and silly questions asked by some 25 million or more persons had their night, and they were entitled to do so. And so now, as we leave the Court of Peace, taps by Private David W. Parker, private in the United States Army from Camp George Washington. Thank you, sir. And it was a swell evening out here tonight, the closing night, and it was a swell show all during 1939. More of it next year. We hope you'll be out here. And now the story of the New York World's Fair 1939 has been written, of course. The show will open again on May 25th, 1940. And now, a flip of the switch, and we bring you Jack Teagarden and his orchestra playing the last number at the Mardi Gras Casino.
So we conclude this broadcast of the official closing ceremonies at the New York World's Fair 1939. With the playing of Auld Lang Syne by Jack Teagarden and his orchestra, we leave you with a vision of an even greater New York World's Fair in 1940. See you next year, everybody. This was a presentation of the Special Features Division of WOR. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.